That's the way this company that's going down the tubes is trying to sell a $25,000 automobile.
That's unbelievable.
What do you think Claude Hopkins would have to say about that?
I don't think he'd be happy.
What do you think John Caples would have to say about that? What would anybody that knew anything about selling anything say about that? I'm telling you, Michael, the advertising, except for the direct response advertiser, is just absolutely a wasteland, which presents an incredible opportunity for students of advertising that will master the time-tested, proven techniques and update them for whatever it is they're selling today. They have an enormous edge because nobody knows what they're doing.
Well stated.
If you get this course and study it, you will know more about what makes advertising sell and how you can make your advertising sell and bring you more money for less cost consistently than anybody else in your field or in your community. And that's because the course was written by a master student of advertising that accessed millions upon millions of dollars worth of results-tested advertising, compiled the common denominators into a system that takes you step-by-step from how to think about advertising before you even start the ad, right down to the final pitch to get the money. You have it all right there, and it's authoritative. It's not available anyplace else, although there are many other advertising books and so on that are useful, but nowhere else is an entire proven, tested system laid out for you step by step that will enable you to turn your what would normally be an advertising expense into a money-generating power.
Hi, this is Michael Senoff with HardToFindSeminars.com. Hold on to your hat because this is the second in a series of interviews with Barry Bedell, the son of master advertising copywriter and consultant Clyde Bedell. In this recording, we're going to explore detail of Clyde Bedell's life from his early beginnings all the way up through his career until the time he passed away. So this part of the recording is going to offer you absolute proof of this man's credentials, absolute proof of the awards he won over all the years, absolute proof that this man was considered one of the all-time greatest advertising geniuses of all time. Listen in as I explore the history of Barry's father, Clyde Bedell. Enjoy. Well, I want to get into a little bit about the history of you and your father, and I want to start building some credibility with your father. So a lot of people who have no idea who he is. So let me just start with this question. Barry, was your dad a genius at this advertising game, or is it something he worked hard at?
Well, he would probably not want to be called a genius, but the answer is yes and yes. He clearly was, in my opinion, and that of many others, an advertising genius, and he also worked like the very devil. So he was an extremely energetic and productive, hardworking individual.
Where did you guys grow up? Where were you born?
I was born in Evanston, Illinois, suburb of Chicago. Grew up along the North Shore and then from around the sixth grade on in Park Ridge, a northwest suburb.
Do you know what your dad was like as a young man?
Oh, yeah.
Where did all this influence come? What was your grandfather like?
Well, his father had died when he was about 14, and he actually became the support of his mother and sister as a teenager. So I never knew my grandfather on that side. On my mother's side, my grandfather was an entrepreneurial kind of a guy who had made a lot of money, lost every bit of it in the Depression. In fact, it had gotten so bad that my dad was having to subsidize my grandparents on that side for a while. But then my grandfather came back real strong, and one of the prized possessions that my father had and that I now have is a set of the 1911 classic leather-bound Encyclopedia Britannica, considered the finest information source on things at the time it was published, of anything even in existence today. And my grandfather educated himself by reading that encyclopedia.
Wow.
So when he passed, it went on to my dad, and I now have it. But basically, my mother came from a family, had six brothers, and was the only girl.
Mm-hmm.
My father had the one sister.
Okay. So as a young man, he was quite energetic, and your grandfather dying when Clyde was 14, being forced into that role where he had to get off his butt and get moving, do you think that had a lot of influence in his early days?
Of course. Back then, he had jobs before and after school, and, of course, in the summer. If you want to know another story that illustrates a principle we all can use today, he got a scholarship to Coe College in Iowa, a small liberal arts college, and somehow ended up in his freshman year taking the men's glee club on a tour. It was very successful. And then the head of the girls' glee club said, well, gee, would you take our glee club on tour? So he ended up taking the girls' glee club on tour as a freshman. Well, I don't need to tell you that his grade suffered.
Right.
His scholarship was not renewed. And so at 18 or 19, he was out of the world with 1 year of college and on his own. He went to Des Moines, the big city in Iowa. And he was sitting at the lunch counter having a bowl of beans and wondering, God, what the heck am I going to do? I've got to get a job. And he heard two fellows next to him talking about a job that they knew about, and one of them was going to go and have an interview. My dad, overhearing this, thought, gee, that sounds pretty interesting. He wolfed down the rest of his beans and got right over to the place where that interview was going on and got hired. As we know, nothing happens until we take action. So he acted. He was a man of action. And the job was as traveling editor for the Merchants Trade Journal, a trade publication for retailers. And so he was traveling around the country, and his job was to go into successful retail businesses, a variety of different kinds, and interview the proprietor and found out what was working and all of that, and then write it up and submit it to this magazine. There is the foundation.
So how many years was he doing this?
Not a whole lot. The main thing is, of course, many advertisers even forget to ask for any action in their ads, which is foolish. Sometimes we end our ads saying, obey that impulse, respond now. Well, he obeyed the impulse to wolf down his beans and go get that job. So taking action is the core principle of success in advertising and selling and in life, I believe. From there, next thing, he was with an advertising agency in Galveston, Texas. And there, chiropractic was just really getting going then, and they didn't have a very good reputation, that people didn't understand it. And he sold the Association of Chiropractors, the Chiropractic Association, that they ought to tell their story in a national magazine. And so they said, that sounds like a good idea, but how are we going to do that? We don't have any money. He says, well, I can get you the money. So he developed a program that was mailed to all the chiropractors that were members of the association and said, let's pony up, fellas, and then we'll write some ads and we'll run them in the Saturday Evening Post.
Do some co-op advertising.
Yeah, the chiropractors were paying for it, the association. And that turned out to be the first kind of therapeutic advertising ever done in the media in the United States. Then he moved on and interesting accounts and ended up in San Francisco with a leading advertising agency at the time called Honig Cooper, working on regional and national accounts. One of the accounts that was most interesting was the Californians Incorporated. People today may find it hard to believe, but back in those days, California was advertising to try to get families to move to California.
Sure.
Another agency, big national agency, Foote, Cone & Belding, had half the account, and Honig Cooper had the other half. And they would do ads, and they were direct response kind of ads because they all had coupons, and the sponsor counted the coupons, so they knew which was working. And my father developed some ads and was able to keep the exact count, and they blew the other agency's ads out of the water. And I still have in the files the specific counts of every one of those ads on how many leads they brought in.
Do you know how many different California ads there were?
There were a lot of them.
You know, I think I have some of those California ads. I remember reading those. They're powerful.
Yeah. So he was there, and as a bachelor living in San Francisco. San Francisco wasn't known for what it is now, but, I mean, just a glorious city, a great time. Everything was going well. When he got a call from a friend of his that he had worked with, I've skipped a lot, he worked for an agency in Chicago also, which is where he had met my mother, as a matter of fact. But this friend from Chicago said, Clyde, there's a great job in Chicago that I've applied for, didn't get, but you seem to be real qualified for. And he described the job and said, why don't you contact him and see if you can get an interview? He did, and the company happened to be Butler Brothers.
Now, who was Butler Brothers? I've heard the name, but...
Well, at that time, they were the world's biggest wholesaler of goods for variety stores. You know, the kind of stuff that you would sell in a, it used to be a Woolworths, Kresge now, I guess, like Kmart and that kind of stuff.
Okay. Did they have retail locations or just...
No, they didn't own them. They sold to retailers.
I got through the mail?
They had representatives and they put out catalogs. But the Butler brother says, yeah, come on back, we'll interview you. Well, then there were no airplanes, so he took the train back to Chicago and interviewed. Oh, before he went, his boss in San Francisco said, Clyde, go ahead by all means. If you get the job, great. If you don't, come on back and forget about it and carry on here. So he had the blessings of his boss. Well, he got the job. That was actually then during the real depression. He played a major role in helping Butler Brothers and their dealers somehow muddle through and survive all that.
I have notes that he headed up a 1,000-person advertising and marketing department.
That's correct. They were doing not only their own catalogs to sell their goods to the stores, but they were doing flyers and things for the stores to mail out to the public. So he ran a big department.
How many years was he there, do you know?
He was there from, I think, around 1930, probably till 1934, something like that.
Was he ultimately appointed to something there?
He was the director of advertising.
So he was the man when it came to advertising for the largest wholesaler in the world at that time?
I believe in the world, certainly in the United States.
I've also got some notes here. His job was to annually produce 7 big catalogs that sold merchandise to hundreds of variety stores.
That's right.
So part of his job was to develop these catalogs?
Develop them, and he converted them from the typical kind of thing that would just show a picture and say ladies' bloomers, and they come in packages of 6 and so on, to have selling headlines and some selling copy with every item.
Tell me about the transition from that job to when he published his book called The 7 Keys to Retail Profits and how that all came about.
Well, that happened during the time he was at Butler Brothers. And it became published by McGraw-Hill, and it became the best-selling book having to do with retailing. One of the reasons it became a bestseller is my father knew how to promote it. He did basically all of the promotion. He got hundreds of testimonials from merchants that had been using the stuff that the Butler Brothers had been putting out, and he got it from newspaper and advertising agency people, and they put that into brochures and used those as part of the advertising, and basically handed McGraw-Hill the stuff that all I had to do was print it and mail it. So it got far more promotion than most business books would, and went through 7 printings, I believe.
Do you have all those promotions still?
Yes, I do.
You do? Okay.
Yeah.
How was this book? Was it foundational material that was also used in his later courses?
Well, that book had more to do with merchandising than with advertising. There was very little advertising content in it. It was primarily on merchandising a variety store. And it built not only on what he'd learned at Butler Brothers, but, of course, from his earlier foundation with the Merchants Trade Journal.
Ford Motor Company. Tell me the transition from Butler Brothers to Ford.
When he was at Butler Brothers, E.B. Butler, who had founded the company, was a man that my father became friends with him and had the highest amount of respect for him. Butler was an extremely high-caliber, fine human being. In fact, he was... For those interested in the history of Chicago's lakefront, which is one of the great of all major cities, it's known for its miles and miles of beautiful beaches and public lakefront and parks. E.B. Butler was one of the principal participants in what became known as the Burnham Plan to convert the lakefront from rail yards and stuff like that into this beautiful public space. E.B. Butler was one of the architects of that. That's just the kind of guy he was. Well, Butler died, and the individuals that took over Butler Brothers were quite the opposite of Butler. They were not as broad gauge. They were more grasping. They had less of a humanitarian approach to things. Quite honestly, my father has always been a very outspoken person, soon found himself at odds with them, and he left the company. He wasn't sure what he was going to do. Now, bear in mind, he had a son at that time, namely me. He had a wife, and it was in the dark days of the Depression. He had no job.
What year was that?
This would have been probably around 1933, 1934.
Okay.
In those days. And I don't know how the lead came, but he somehow, he was well known because of his work at Butler Brothers and the success of this book, Seven Keys to Retail Profit. In any event, he was able to interview with the advertising agency NW Air, which had the Detroit Motor Company account.
Was Air at that time one of the largest advertising agencies in the world?
Yes, but he went to Detroit, and what they were interested in was they were interested in selling more Ford cars. They had the Ford account, which was a huge account. He ended up with them. It ended up that he was making more money than the head of the Detroit office, but that wouldn't fly if the head of the Detroit office knew it, so they were basically paying him less and sending him a separate check from their headquarters. But they wanted him that badly, which was quite a tribute, particularly in those days. And what he did there was he developed for Ford Motor Company a sales training program. First he developed the concept, he sold it to Ford Motor Company, and then he developed the sales training program that was implemented in every Ford dealership in the country. And it was basically a phonograph record with a little ding, and then a film strip that would show the next graphic.
What do you mean a phonograph record with a little ding?
Well, a phonograph record would have audio on it.
Right.
And there would be a film strip with a video. And then when the little ding came,
you put the video on.
The next video went on.
Do you have that?
I think I may have that someplace.
So this is a sales training program for Ford Motor Company for all their dealers.
That's right.
To train, show them how to sell cars.
To show the salesman how to sell automobiles.
Wow.
Also, in addition to that, he developed and wrote the big color manuals or portfolios that they had in all of the showrooms. Now you go into a showroom and they give you a big glossy brochure, pictures of the car, not a whole lot of information. In those days, they didn't give the customer a brochure, but they had in the showroom a very thorough and comprehensive, in effect, booklet, maybe 100, 200 pages, with all the pictures of all the models, all of the options, all the technical features. He approached that first on the sales training thing, turned everything around from features into benefits, stressed the benefits rather than the features. And the same thing in this manual. This all happened.
Okay.
And 1935 was the only year that Ford outsold their big rival, Chevrolet, for many years prior to then and up through 1939-40 when they stopped making cars because of World War II and well on into the 50s after World War II. So that had a tremendous impact.
Did he help write some of the space ads that went in the newspaper and magazine publications to sell the cars that year?
No. I don't believe he did anything to do with the media advertising.
Okay.
It was the sales training program and this big full-color spiral-bound book they had in the showroom.
Do you have a copy of that?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Is it pretty amazing?
It is.
Would that have been for the year models, either 1934?
It was for 35 Ford.
35 Ford, okay.
Right. Yeah, and I believe he did the same thing for 36 Ford also. Buying a new car back in those days, in the Depression, that was a pretty big event.
Yeah.
And they were basically the salesman. Some of the dialogue, as he had listened to salesmen and knew how they talked, they would get the hood up and say, well, he sure is powerful. And got 8 cylinders in there and talk about some of the features like that, but didn't talk about how quick starting this car is and how even in the cold of winter it turns over right away. You never have to worry about getting it started, how smooth it purrs as you drive down the road, and the ventilation system is letting fresh air flow in under the cowl and translating it into benefits. So he developed that whole system for them. So after he left, he was doing this for NW Air, and James O. McKenzie, the founder of the McKenzie Management Consulting Firm, which is still top flight consulting company in the United States today. McKenzie's, the headquarters, I believe, were in Chicago. McKenzie had obtained Marshall Field & Company, then the premier quality department store in Chicago, as a client. And McKenzie wanted Clyde to join them in Chicago as a part of McKenzie. And after negotiations and so on, he accepted an offer with McKenzie & Company and went back to Chicago and analyzed what needed to be done to get Marshall Field & Company really kicking on all cylinders. And I remember in particular they were concerned about one of their suburban branch stores and whether they should close it down or not. If they didn't close it down, what would they do to keep it, turn it around and make it profitable? Same kind of things that goes on today. He did that, and then McKenzie was asked to become chairman of the board of Marshall Field. As chairman of the board, he had become aware of how poor retail advertising was in general and for Marshall Fields in particular. And he persuaded my father to leave McKenzie and take over the advertising at Marshall Fields.
At that time, what was Marshall Fields? Were they a retailer or a wholesaler?
Marshall Fields was the premier prestige retailer. I guess the Neiman Market. So that's how he got into retail. In the 30s, there was nobody competing for awards or looking for the plaudits of their peers by getting a trophy at a big dinner. The whole bottom line was, my God, we've got to sell merchandise. We're going to go broke if we don't get more people in here, buy more stuff. The emphasis was on selling, not on branding or not on image or not on looking beautiful or anything like that. Although, one of the contributions that Clyde is known for coffee, one of the things he did for Marshall Fields was to go out and locate and hire some of the, one in particular, top flight freelance illustrators to improve the image of the graphics of the merchandise. So not to discount the importance of graphics in advertising in any way, but they were pretty awful, both ugly in terms of graphics and in type and very little copy in those days.
Well, how long did he stay with Marshall Fields? Do you have any idea?
He was there until the late 30s.
Making great money.
Doing well, yeah. He was very fortunate. He had always been able to do well even throughout the Depression, which was quite amazing. In any event, World War II got going, and massive war bond drives were used to finance the war, selling defense bonds or war bonds. All of the merchants, the department stores and the big independent or specialty stores on State Street were part of what they call the State Street Council, and they would have big promotions, which they all participated to sell war bonds. And the military would come in, they'd bring in artillery and tanks, there'd be entertainers, and it was a big event. And all cities had something comparable to, and all industries to, the whole country was united in selling bonds to finance World War II. Clyde developed the print advertising for the war bonds campaign in Chicago. He got a top-flight illustrator to illustrate them. You have a copy of his advertising course.
Yeah, is it in there, the war bond ad?
One of the war bond ads is on the cover of Part 8.
Oh, Part 8, okay.
And they're very emotional type of copy.
Yeah, I've got it in front of me.
Yeah, I guess it was in mid-1942.
Yeah, there it is.
And it was not just buy war bonds, support the troops or something, but, I mean, it was in these ads that made them so unusual, and they were copied all over the United States, was the powerful emotional appeal in those ads.
Yeah.
We know that people buy through their emotions, that emotional appeals work far better than strictly rational appeals. You make the emotional appeal, and then they use reason to back up and justify the emotions. But these war bond ads were high emotion. they were tremendously successful.
I have some books that are available called All American Ads. You heard of those? All American Ads of the 30s, All American Ads of the 40s, of the 50s, of the 60s, of the 70s. This publisher has taken and reprinted in full color these big volume books of all these fantastic ads. And I remember seeing, you know, in the 30s, these type ads. One in particular written by Bruce Barton. But yeah, these are very powerfully
right. Well,
written.
Bruce Barton, of course, was one of the really all-time advertising greats. And again, a terrific human being.
Do you know how many different Warbound ads there were?
I don't know how many. Of this particular campaign, I think he did the ads for two campaigns. But of this campaign, I have several of them, and I think I probably have the full collection. I'm not sure whether there were six or eight, something.
How much did it raise? Do you have any idea?
It sold $84 million of bonds in July, which doesn't sound like much now, but that's when a suit of clothes might cost $25. So, I mean, it was big money in those days.
Wow.
And it was widely copied through the United States and even in England.
Very good. Okay. Who were some of your father's mentors? Who did he study? Other than his experience around retail, was he studying the other mentors? Did he spend a lot of time in the library?
Well, he had studied Claude Hopkins. He had Albert Lasker. He had studied one that most people don't know of today, Walter Dill Scott, who became the president of Northwestern University.
That's the end of part one with Barry Bedell. Please continue to part two.